Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Just a brief note before we get going. Beginning March 30th, KAKM-TV will air for three consecutive nights Ken Burns' most recent documentary on the history of cancer. This is based on Siddhartha Mukherjee's really wonderful book, The Emperor of All Maladies. To kind of dovetail on this upcoming documentary, we decided to discuss colon cancer epidemiology and screening. My guests today are Diana Redwood. She is a PhD, MPH, epidemiologist with the Alaska Tribal, our Native Health Consortium. I never get that right. And she's really the manager of the colorectal cancer program there. Also joining me is Heidi Baines. Heidi is the medical director of quality integration with the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. So the issues today are, this is a preventable disease. We'll talk about why we know that or why we suspect that that can be, because it's certainly not completely eradicated by any means, and how we screen for it. The epidemiology is the who, what, when, where, how kind of aspects, and we'll integrate the screening and what's right for each individual. If you've got questions or comments, there are several ways over the next hour you can get in touch with us. In Anchorage, you can call us directly at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We have an email address, line1. You have to spell it out, all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Heidi and Diana, it's just great to have you join me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
Yeah, Diana, let me start with you. I use the word epidemiology all the time. Tell the listeners what epidemiologists do for a living.
Well, it's not treating skin disease, which is usually the first thought people have. Epidemiology is really studying disease and populations. So we look at health on the larger realm. People sometimes think about the flu and where flu is and where it spreads. Those are the kind of things that epidemiologists look at. But we also look at chronic diseases and other types of things, such as cancer tracking.
Okay. A lot of the studies that epidemiologists do are what are called observational studies. They notice associations between things.
That's right. There's a number of different types of studies, and the observational is the simplest and what often leads to more complex studies, where sometimes you study a group of people over time and see what diseases develop and what doesn't develop and look at risk and protective factors.
I mention that only because so often there's a lot of observational studies, some of which are not necessarily even well done, that get into the media, and people misinterpret those as related to causation. And that is not what observational studies do. And if there's an area right now that may be getting cleaned up, it's the nutritional observational studies, which really foul people up, whether coffee this week and various and sundry things next week are good and bad for you. And it relates back to how the study's done, what the purpose of the study was.
That's true.
All right. Heidi, you're at the Neighborhood Health Center.
Yes.
You're a family physician.
Yes.
So tell us about the Neighborhood Health Center and what you do.
Well, as you probably know, or as many listeners may know or may not know, we're a community health center, which means we are a federally granted center, providing health care to people regardless of their ability to pay. We're family medicine, so we serve from newborns through elders, and we use our small, our portion of grant funding to help support patients who don't have insurance or uninsured, or have insurance but can't afford their whole deductible, because there's a lot of people like that out there as well. And we provide primary care. That's really our base. We provide dental care, and we have care coordination services, integrated behavioral health, and other support services to try to help reduce barriers so that people can get to a better place in health.
And I've been listening to you and Diana talk before we went on the air. Somehow you got drug into this whole issue of colorectal screening in a big way. Is that part of the quality improvement?
Yeah.
Efforts?
So I'm the director of quality integration there and oversee a lot of different quality measures as well as process improvement. And it's kind of a broad position. And we decided to make colorectal cancer screening one of our measure of focus last year, and have worked really hard to try to put into place a procedure and process that will be sustainable and work for our patients over time. And part of that is figuring out, you know, some of the barriers to screening for people. You know, we have a lab and we're able to provide the stool test, the home stool test screening, which is a very good test for many, many people. However, if you have a positive stool test, then you really need to have a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that we provide within our center. And so how that gets paid for is not totally up to us. We had been fortunate in the past to work with Ride for Life, which was an organization that ran the Bicycle Ride to Seward by Larry Holman, and were granted some money that we worked with some of the local gastroenterologists to support patients who had a need for colonoscopy. He's retired. That organization has changed. And so, you know, we're continuing looking for ways to partner so that these patients that need screening or need further screening after a positive test can get what they need, because colon cancer is preventable if we find it early enough.
Okay. All right. So let's back down just a little bit in the idea of what we're talking about today. And Diana, I'm going to start with you and just ask you to describe, you know, what we know, kind of what's the epidemiology of colon cancer, colorectal cancer.
Well, colorectal cancer, and sometimes people ask what that is, and it just means cancer that arises in either the colon or the rectum, which other times people know it as the large intestine, so mm-hmm. or the bowel. And basically, it's the third leading cause of cancer death in men and women in the United States. It causes about 50,000 deaths a year. There's about 140,000 new cases diagnosed every year. And the thing that's there's been a big push in the last number of years towards screening for the cancer, because it is something that you can screen for and detect early and treat and thus reduce those deaths.
What do we know about the natural history of the lesions or the cancer that makes it susceptible to early diagnosis? And therefore, the idea is if we find it early, we can intervene and make it less likely to cause death or problems.
Yeah. So colorectal cancer, about 90% of it starts as these small lesions called polyps, or growths on the inside of the colon, that slowly, slowly grow over time through the colon wall and then can spread throughout the rest of the body. But this progression called the adenoma carcinoma sequence, it actually takes about 10 to 15 years to occur. It's a very slow growing. So in that, it presents us with a window of opportunity to detect and treat it early before it can grow and become cancer. So that's one of the things that often surprise people, is that it's something you remove the precancerous polyps before they even become cancer, and that then prevents the cancer from occurring.
It seems to me, as a pediatrician who does not dwell in this area at great depth, but because of the program, actually, I'm talking to people all the time, and I have a kind of natural curiosity about medicine, is that there is a increasing, I'm choosing my words carefully, awareness that many cancers may be present for a long period of time, just like colorectal cancer. So this is not a unique idea.
Correct. The thing that's so hard about it, too, in a way, is that because it can be prevented and treated early, when you can treat it early, it's a lot more successful. So it's actually the 5-year survival rate for colorectal cancer, if it's found early or in stage 1 or 2, is about 90%. So that's 90% of people that have that then live for at least 5 years. Now that drops significantly down if it has progressed throughout the body, so say stage four, then it's only about a 13% 5-year survival rate. So there's quite a bit of things that we can do if we find it early that we can't do if we find it late.
So when physicians talk about staging, stage one is it's relatively well in the lesion. Two, it's spread just locally. Three, it's beginning to metastasize. Am I? This is not my
It's the depth of the lesion from the mucosal layer. So the polyp.
Mucosa is the outside surface.
The mucosa is the lining of the gut, right? It's a tube, and it has this mucosa that's the lining. So the different stages have to do with the depth, and then the fourth would be the distal, where it's now you're finding abnormal colon cells in other parts of your body, which don't belong there, obviously.
Yeah, we don't think about it, but our intestines are just exposed to the air, and it's just like our mouth is. It's just a tube running right down through the middle
of us.
That's
right.
So the mucosa is that lining, a lot like the mucosa inside your cheek.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And the skin is the other part. So our body is interacting with the environment throughout our intestinal tract, our skin, and our respiratory tract, which we're becoming more and more aware about. This is pretty important.
Yeah.
What are risk factors then? Let's start with most of us Alaskans, and then we'll talk about natives and other individuals who may have migrated here.
Yeah, so I can start with that. So when we talk about risk factors for any disease, really we're talking about modifiable and non-modifiable, so things we can change and things we can't change. And so this is important in colon cancer screening because it gets to when people should start screening and obviously for people who are working on prevention, what they can look at. So when we look at non-modifiable, we know that things we can't change are your sex, if you're male or female. So male is a little bit higher risk. If you have a family history, so that would be if you have a first-degree relative. So first-degree is a parent or brother, sister, or if you have other relatives. Also, if you've had colon cancer in the past, you know, say you had it and it was resolved, or you had a certain kind of polyp that was at risk, then you're at higher risk. And then other medical conditions that cause inflammatory situations in your bowel can lead you to be at a higher risk. Just inflammation has such a big role in cancer and all kinds of things in our body. I think we're learning more and more about that every day. So there's a lot of ways that we can have inflammation. But the things that, you know, really to focus on, so I would say for the non-modifiable, the thing that you have control over is knowing your history, knowing your family history, and going to get screened, you know, at the appropriate age. That's the thing you can change about that. For things that we can't, that we do have more control over are all those things that keep us healthy in other ways as well. It's no surprise. So increased risk for people who are obese or very overweight, who increased risk if you're not very physically active. Increased risk if you smoke. Again, that's getting to inflammation and other toxins. If you are drinking more than the recommended amount of alcohol on a regular basis, and also a high red meat or processed meat diet. So conversely, you know, getting enough physical activity, eating a good healthy diet, having enough of those vitamins and vitamin D, especially that we need in Alaska, things like that, and not smoking or quitting smoking can have an impact.
All right, is it significantly different, or are there especially important differences in Native Alaskans for risk?
Yes, Alaska Native people experience 2 times the rate of colorectal cancer, both new cases of cancer and deaths due to cancer, as U.S. whites. So there's quite a significant health disparity between the two. And people sometimes ask, well, is there something specific within the Alaska Native, maybe genetics or, you know, different population? And so far, there doesn't seem to be anything specific that we know about in terms of genetics. But the risk factors that Heidi mentioned are the same things that impact risk in Alaska Native people. So those modifiable things and getting screened are really important.
I want to come back to this, but I think I'm going to take one brief second and just remind listeners, if you've got questions or comments today about colorectal cancer and screening in particular, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us over the next 45 minutes. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email, line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Neither one of you mentioned age, or I didn't hear it if you did. And I want to comment on that, not to be critical if you didn't, if you forgot to mention it, but that so my understanding is when we look at diseases in general right now, I think many people think our environmental influences are the most important. And my understanding is for most diseases, that's not true. It's genetics to a large degree, socioeconomic standing, which seems hard for people to understand, but we're not going to get into that. It's not necessarily medical care, and we're seeing a lot more cancers because we're living longer relative to the idea that we have poorer diets, we have da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which gets back to some of the quality of the studies. Now, I absolutely am not in the business of giving them false information, so I want to see what you all say about that.
Yeah, actually, thanks for bringing that up, because age is actually the number one risk factor,
right.
And we know that... what is it? I have here 90% of colon cancers occur in people age 50 and older. Right. So it's the most important risk factor when you think right. about it. And I think when you look at those numbers and when they talk about when to start screening and when, you know, when is it when to stop screening, we're looking at, you know, 50 and older, partly because that's when you start to really see the increase in the number of cancers. And, you know, I think that we see that, I mean, all these things are so complex, and the interplay between all the different factors, it really starts to show up in many ways, right, as people
right.
age.
Right.
So, yeah, right. thanks for is it, knowing well, that.
No, it's okay. My point is we just hear so much about our diet and everything, and in fact, I guess I'd argue our diet, we're living longer, right? So somehow we gotta understand how that could be, and yet it's causing all our problems. But anyway.
Well, you have to think about quality of life as you age, right? You might be living longer,
right.
but with how much help?
Yeah, and that's another issue is if we are going to live longer, we need to be addressing some of our issues like
right.
Obesity so that the quality of life during that
exactly.
longer expense. I understand that. How about natives? Is it Native Alaskans, is there an issue? Is it also occur younger? You said it happens more often and you're more likely to die, but is there any evidence that it's occurring younger, suggesting that its origins are even younger?
Alaska Native people seem to have higher rates of colorectal cancer at every age group, but the average age of diagnosis is a couple years younger in Alaska Native people than in non-Native people, which mm-hmm. is why we've been focusing so much at the Alaska Tribal Health Consortium on increasing screening across the state.
And the reasons for that, I heard you say earlier, is we don't know.
Not entirely, but, you know, some of the risk factors, we have higher smoking rates. Alaska Native people are about 40% smoking rate versus the statewide average is about 20%. So there's certain risk factors, as Heidi said, that impact all people. And so if you have those risk factors, then that impacts your colorectal cancer risk.
So here's an email that's come in that gets to the genetic origins of this problem. It says, on my last 5-year colonoscopy, I had 9 polyps removed. Previously, I've typically had 2 to 3 polyps removed. I have a family history of colon cancer. He does not give me his age. Let's assume he's this is a man, I don't know, even for a man or woman, it's got to be at least probably 50 or so. Should I be tested for Lynch syndrome? If I have Lynch syndrome, what is the treatment and what is the colonoscopy protocol frequency? So anybody want to comment? Lynch is a genetic disorder that predisposes to cancers, and I don't, off the top of my head, know what the problem is there relative to like BRCA 1 and 2 with women who have a problem with the, basically cleaning up the genetic errors is not as good. You guys familiar with that and know the answer? So, yeah, my answer would be whoever did your colonoscopies, where I'd go back and be asking about that question. I think it is an important one. There are definitely people who have more history of risk of colon cancer who don't have Lynch syndrome. So, I think that is an important question to get asked. And obviously, it seems to me, whoever did the colonoscopy, if you had the colonoscopies done out of state, you can't get back to that person. I would see if your primary care physician could answer that question for you by talking to a gastroenterologist or referring you to a gastroenterologist, who would be the most likely person to answer that question.
Just a comment. I think, you know, it's important to understand what kind of polyps they're removing, the size, and also that not every polyp is precancerous, and only about 10% of them, I think, progress to be cancer. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, the person, the primary care provider, the gastroenterologist looking at the pathology report is sort of taking all those factors into consideration and making a recommendation for, you know, when do you need your next test? Do you need other further testing and things like that? But they absolutely are looking at, you know, many different factors in interpreting your, you know, each individual situation.
Okay. And that's something that we all here, I think, will agree that each individual situation is very important to be considered. There are guidelines for the vast majority of us, but there's always little nuances about family history or genetics or your own disease history that might increase your risk. And that came up when we were talking about a history of colon cancer. I was wondering in my own mind, what if you had a history of other cancers? Is that a risk factor by itself? Let's say you had a history of breast cancer. Does that ring any bells for anybody? I don't know that it is. I'm just...
You know, I don't... It may be that there are some rare things, but I'm just trying to think. It's not something that we talk to people about. It's not one of the things that we look at when we're saying, are you a high risk or a low risk, you know, or average risk.
So it might be something that an individual who's talking to their physicians about their risks and what they should do and mentioning that they themselves may be a cancer survivor, and that may change the recommendations for that you're going to hear about later that we're going to give you in general.
And it is true. There's more and more people. There's about 1 million colorectal cancer survivors across the U.S. as more people are getting screened and found and treated early. So that's important to talk to the provider about.
So let's stay with that for just a second. So one of the evidences that early detection is helpful is that we're seeing longer and longer survivors, at least the stage one, stage two, as you implied earlier.
Yes. Well, and as screening has gone up across the country, the colorectal cancer incidence and mortality has been going down. So deaths due to cancer and new cases of cancer have been declining in the last 20 years across the U.S.
And to put that in some perspective, I just wrote this down. This came across since I last interacted with you. A CDC study showed that this is a 63% five-year survival rate of colon cancer. That's all colorectal cancer. You'd mentioned stage one and stage two, so those would be more likely to live. And that compares with breast and prostate, which are about 88% and 97%. So again, some evidence that if we could get suggestive evidence that we could get it to colon cancer earlier, that we might continue to improve on those statistics considerably, it would sound like.
Yes.
So we've talked a lot about colon cancer. Where is it in the colon? Your colon starts just past your small intestine where there's an appendix, and everything empties into that large intestine and all the way down to your rectum. So there's a loop up the right side of your abdomen, across the top of your abdomen, just below your where your diaphragm is in the middle of the chest, then down the left side. That's the ascending colon, the transverse colon, the descending colon, and then the rectum. Where are these guys?
Where are the cancers found?
Yeah, where do we know for each particular place? Because, again, if we're going to get into making recommendations, it might be nice to know where we're looking.
Right, right. Well, you know, in anatomy, we talk about proximal and distal, so that's sort of how they name the colon, where the locations are. But the majority, and there are differences that are based on by sex and by age, but in general, more of the cancers are found in the proximal colon. So that would be the part of the colon that comes off of the small intestine. So farther in, I guess, if you're coming from your rectum. And what I, you know, what I also have seen is that the older people have ones that are more proximal, and the younger ones are found more in a rectal location. So important in screening, in that some of the trends in screening, we used to see a lot more flexible sigmoidoscopy done maybe 10, 15 years ago. And the flexible sigmoidoscopy looks at the more distal or the left side of the colon, the sigmoid area. And so if you're looking at cancers that are growing or precancers that are growing in the proximal area, it's not going to they're not going to be viewed with a flexible sigmoidoscope. Mm-hmm. But they can be found with stool testing.
Mm-hmm. About symptoms, when do symptoms occur? What are the symptoms?
So I like to think about the symptoms as being a result of either bleeding or blocking. So you can detect symptoms that are a patient can detect at a certain point, sort of later in the disease, and that is if there is a lot of bleeding or just an accumulation of bleeding, and these polyps can bleed if they're sticking out, if they're a kind of polyp that sticks out, not a flat type of polyp, which is another kind. When things go by, like your stool, they can cause a little bleeding, or they can bleed on their own. And so sometimes patients will have bleeding or change in the color of their stool, indicating bleeding, depending on how far up the colon it is, that will bring them in. Or they can present with anemia, mm-hmm. meaning that their blood count is just low over time, and that presents more as a, you know, fatigue or tiredness, different symptoms. And then you can have symptoms that are of a blocking nature. So when we talk to patients about that, we talk about, you know, a change in your stool, a change in the size of it, a change in the consistency or the character. And hopefully we won't be finding that with increased screening, right? Because that would indicate we have a really large blockage that wasn't picked up earlier. So those are the kind of symptoms that people come in. But, you know, changes in the bowel, in the character, the size, the color of the stool definitely would be something to talk to someone about.
But we often say, too, that the most common symptom is no symptoms at all.
Right. That's exactly right. That's why we have screening.
Well, listening to the story on what we know about development, it sounds like early on there would be very little symptoms and maybe even no bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
Later there may be some bleeding. Real late, again, generalization, real late, anemia, long-term bleeding, and blockage. And so, again, the natural history of this is you want to get there before, at least for sure, the more later symptoms that may occur.
Yeah. And the, you know, the balance of screening is to do the screening often enough that you're going to pick something up before it becomes symptomatic.
Right.
And the slow-growing nature of colon cancer really presents a great opportunity for that.
And yeah, Dr. Redwood, I think it's important to just go back to what you said. The most important thing is to do this before you have symptoms and mm-hmm. not get too esoteric on when the symptoms may lead to stuff. So obvious blood in the stool, it would be an important factor, but you might be bleeding and not see that blood just because you're bleeding doesn't mean it might be obvious.
Right. And bleeding can be, there can be a lot of different reasons for bleeding in the stool and bleeding from the rectum, and that can be challenging to sort out.
All right. We are roughly halfway through. Typically, those of you who listen know we take a short break, so I'm going to do that right now and remind everyone we're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433 if you've got questions. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752 and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and we'll continue our discussion on colorectal cancer with Dr. Diana Redwood and Dr. Heine Baines. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. We originate from KSKA Studios in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our topic is the epidemiology of and screening recommendations for colorectal cancer. My guests are Dr. Diana Redwood. She's an epidemiologist with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Did I do it right that time?
You did.
I get it backwards every time. And Dr. Heidi Baines, who is a family practitioner with the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, really involved with improving quality, and they've taken on the task of trying to make sure that they're doing all they can to look for colorectal cancer and figure out why there may be barriers to getting that done in their facility. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember, we do have a rebroadcast between 9 and 10, which is a taped rebroadcast on Monday evenings, and we won't be able to answer questions, although you can always go to our archives at alaskapublic.org. Look up the Line 1 link and the archives and listen to the program, or even refer somebody to listen to the program you think would benefit from hearing it. One final thing before we get back to today's program. I really want people to know that there will be a great documentary on the history of cancer starting on 3 consecutive nights produced by Ken Burns, based on the book The Emperor of All Maladies by cancer specialist Siddhartha Mukherjee. That starts March 30th. It'll be each night for 3 consecutive nights on KAKM. All right, so we've kind of looked into what we know about cancer, bowel cancer, colorectal cancer, and from that, experts pull together the best information they can and come up with specific recommendations of who and when and what kind of screening that should be done. So let's touch base on that. Heidi, I said I'd hit you first about this. Tell us what general the recommendations are for Alaskans, and then I'm going to have Heidi or Diana talk about how that may differ for Native, and maybe just keep in mind everybody's an individual and there may be some variations depending on your history.
Yeah, certainly. So we generally in family medicine follow the United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines for screening recommendations, but it's important to note there are different guidelines out there. There are American Cancer Society guidelines. There are guidelines put out by specialty organizations, and there's overlap, but as with any guideline set, there can be small differences. But in general, the recommendation is that all people ages 50 through 75 be screened with an appropriate test for colon cancer, colorectal cancer. And the guidelines right now, the United States Preventive Service Task Force, are under review. There are some newer tests on the market and some older ones that aren't used as much. But the recommendations in general for the major ones are that the screening be performed using colonoscopy every 10 years or a stool, an appropriate high sensitivity stool test done at home annually. Those are the two basic ones that we follow. And though there are some others that are still acceptable out there, and it's probably best to talk with one's individual provider about what's going to be best for them.
Okay. I have some questions coming in about what seems to be those particular issues, which we can come back and work at. Diana, how about your recommendations or the Native recommendations and why they may differ again?
Yeah. In 2013, a group convened to look at the rates of colorectal cancer in Alaska Native people and look at the differences between Alaska Native colorectal cancer and non-Native populations, and decided to change the guidelines slightly for Alaska Native people so that screening starts at age 40 instead of age 50, like the rest of the population. This is somewhat similar for there is another population that's recommended to start early. African American folks are recommended to start at age 45, also due to issues with higher mortality rates and lower age at diagnosis. So the Alaska Native Medical Center put out the guidelines to start screening at age 40, and that is also being picked up by tribal health organizations statewide. Of course, each one makes the decision which guidelines to follow. But for most of Alaska, we are following the age 40 to start screening among Alaska Natives.
And your recommendation is colonoscopy or also the stool high
Yeah, the fecal immunochemical test, or FIT test, is the one that is also recommended. Colonoscopy is preferred, but a lot of places in Alaska, you don't have access to a colonoscopy, or you don't have access very often, or people don't want to do a colonoscopy. And so one of the major things that we try and emphasize is that the screening test, the best screening test, is the one that actually gets done. And so whatever test that an individual is comfortable with, that's what we really want them to get done so that they can try and prevent this disease.
I had a quick email question. Is there any evidence that the presence of hemorrhoids or infrequent stooling, let's say greater than every 3 days, is an increased risk for colorectal cancer?
I'm not aware of any relationship between hemorrhoids and colorectal cancer at all, but I would say infrequent stooling, maybe not a direct risk, but definitely something to be looking at and just thinking about all those factors that are playing into each other.
Yeah, so that if a change in the stool frequency or consistency and so forth is a possible, don't overreact to that, but it may be worth discussing with somebody.
Yeah, or what are the other factors going into creating that infrequent stool, right? Is it a lack of physical activity? Is it one of those other healthy lifestyle things, fiber, things like that?
Okay. All right. Jean, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, my husband is 69 now, and he had a colonoscopy probably 20 years ago, and he said the stuff he had to take to prepare for it made him so sick that he's just never wanted to go back and try another one.
Yep.
I was just wondering if there's, I've had two colonoscopies since, and, it was unpleasant, but it didn't make me sick. But he said he actually got physically sick.
Right.
So is there something else that they can take nowadays, or should he try to do this test?
Yeah, let me ask Heidi's answer to that.
Yeah, there's different preps, and a lot of times people say the prep is worse than the actual test because you may have sedation or something during the test. And every individual is unique. Funny story just about my mom. She told me that she went and had her colonoscopy, or she was having something done, and they gave her the most delicious drink. And it turned out that it was magnesium citrate, which I don't think anyone else in the world would describe that as a most delicious drink. So individuals are all different. But, you know, fit is, if you are of average risk and are not having symptoms, fit, that fecal immunochemical test is a perfectly acceptable alternative. And if your husband hasn't been screened in 20 years, then he's due for something. And if the prep for the colonoscopy is a barrier, then he should probably talk about what their options are.
Okay, thank you.
Jean, I'm going to throw in one other thing here is we're increasingly learning from behavioral economics how to talk to patients and how we all make decisions, including us physicians. I'm not going to delete us from this whole business. And we often make decisions based on emotions and feelings, not facts. He needs to get screened again and talk with the physician about how he might overcome this problem. There are options and certainly different ones than in the past.
Well, I guess his doctor suggested a liquid diet beforehand.
Yeah. You know, it really gets complicated. I mean, how accurate a colonoscopy might be may depend on how well you're cleaned out as well as the operator themselves. Yeah. So there's a number of issues and really needs to be discussed independently. It's the volume of the liquid that is sometimes difficult, at least it's been my personal. It doesn't taste good, but to work well, you need a certain amount of volume of liquid to work to make it work well, too.
Okay, and what was this test, this other test? It was F-I-T. F-I-T.
Now, is that, T as in Tom, that's
okay.
a looking for blood, or is it, so it's microscopic amounts of bleeding that might be present that you can't otherwise see. And is it, you guys here, tell me if I'm wrong, there are things that can give you a false positive. Eating too much red meat is no longer, I'm getting a shaking. What may give it a false positive? Other diseases, I guess, of the colon?
Other causes of human blood.
Yeah.
The benefit of the fecal immunochemical test versus the GWIAC test is that you're looking at these immunochemical markers that are more specific for human blood rather than other
All right, so
blood.
What you're eating is not the critical as
correct.
When I was
younger.
Not
with the FIT test, but
yep.
There are still other tests out there, and it's important, also really important for patients to know that this is a test they do at home. This is not a test that you have done in the office.
Mm-hmm. So you take it home, collect
mm-hmm.
it. And,
mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so that's an option, Jean.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Penny, you're on line one.
Hello there. I have a question and then a quick reason for why I'm asking the question. The question is there an age past which you should not have a colonoscopy? And the reason I'm asking the question is my mother died as a result of a colonoscopy that nicked her colon,
right.
And they didn't catch it,
right.
And she got peritonitis and died. Now, she
yep.
was in her 80s.
Yep.
I am in my 70s.
Yep.
What's the proved answer?
Yep. Good question. Unfortunate question to arise, but there is what I heard you guys saying is after 75, it's not recommended.
Not necessarily. It's after 75, you should be having that conversation with your provider.
Okay.
Because it really, we're looking at something that's slow growing, mm-hmm. and we're looking at quality of life and the wellness of the person. And so for simplification, we talk about 50 to 75, but we may have people living very healthy, very well into their 90s, and it may be appropriate for them to continue to get screened.
Mm-hmm.
Very personal conversation with the provider based on your health.
And that decision should get into the issues like what's the risk of the procedures.
The
FIT test would have extremely low risk, but may have some false positivity. Colonoscopy does have some risk. I think the risk of bowel perforation in good hands is pretty low, but not zero.
Right.
All right. That help you, Penny?
Oh, that sure did. Thank you.
All right. You have a good day. Another email that would you please discuss if there's much information between the association of anal fistulas, pilonidal cysts, Crohn's disease, and colorectal cancers. You'd mentioned Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease as being an increased risk. The other two, I'm guessing, probably don't have a true big risk. Yep.
Yeah, that's correct. Inflammatory disease like Crohn's disease, definitely they fall into a higher risk category.
And
can you get anal fistulas and you related to Crohn's disease? Then you get into this issue of you can get some perirectal disease with some of the inflammatory bowel disease. So again, it really, you have to be careful. Pyelonephritis don't raise any red flags to me at all for colorectal cancer. All right, let's take another phone call. Jerry, you're on line one. Yeah, oops, Jerry's gone. He had something about age. All right, so let's go through all the screening options that people may have heard of just off the top of your heads. And Diana, I'm going to hit you about this one.
Sure. Well, I think Heidi addressed some of them, but colonoscopy is a thin, flexible tube that goes in through the rectum, and the colonoscopist uses to look inside the colon. That's why you have to have the bowel prep beforehand to clean it out so that they can see any possible polyps that might be inside. And if they do see them, they can actually remove them at that time. They use various techniques, one of which is just a snare, which looks like a little lasso, that they can pinch them off, and they then take bits of it off and send it off to get biopsied, which basically just means a little piece of tissue that then the pathologist looks at and sees if it has precancerous tissue, if it is precancerous tissue. So the colonoscopy visualizes the entire colon. The flexible sigmoidoscopy looks at the first third of the colon. And then there's stool tests.
From the rectum.
From the rectum up, yep. And then stool tests, the FIT, the fecal immunochemical test, or the guaiac fecal immunochemical, or excuse me, the guaiac fecal occult blood test, or occult just means hidden blood. So basically those tests, the stool tests, are looking for hidden blood in the stool. And so they, the reason they are done annually instead of like the colonoscopy every 10 years or the flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years is that you need to do it because they could miss the presence of blood in the stool. They need to be done annually so that you might detect it the succeeding year. So there's a number of different options, and again, it's as we say, you know, the test is the best done that gets done, and so we really try and encourage screening. And there's actually some national initiatives going on trying to increase the screening rate across the nation, because there are certain groups that aren't getting as much screening done as others.
What about virtual colonoscopy? What about this stuff I hear, and I have an email already about DNA testing in the stool? What do we know about those? Why aren't they recommended?
Yeah.
Will they be recommended?
So that's a good question. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is the national body that reviews available literature and decides on guidelines for recommended screening tests based on the studies. And as far as I know, they are currently reviewing the literature for the stool DNA test. The commercial name for that is Cologuard. It's been approved by the FDA and also approved by Medicare Medicaid, but it's not yet part of the national guidelines, the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force. So it probably, you know, as part of the review process, I anticipate it coming into the guidelines in 2016, but not yet.
All right. Jerry's back on the telephone. Jerry, what can we do for you?
Hey, yeah, I got a question. I'd like to know if they could speak a little further on any sources of funding, if anything is found. I mean, I'm like that because I'm afraid they're going to find something that I don't have insurance or money to pay for it.
Okay.
It's like DNA. It's like you want to know you have a chance of getting cancer or it's hereditary or something, you know, without being able to do anything about it. So
right.
I'm just wondering if there are other sources of funding or who would help to
Yeah, good question. We were going to get to that, hopefully, and those are barriers. One of the barriers is cost. Heidi, you want to address that?
Yeah. So there's a couple of different ways to think about that. Let me think. So the concern about having a positive test, like a stool test, which is can be pretty affordable, especially if you are accessing services as a at a place like a community health center that has a sliding fee scale, the lab test will be on the sliding fee scale and be affordable, or they can work with you. And many other doctors' offices will also make a payment plan, or you know, work with patients who are trying to take care of their health. But I understand for a lot of patients it is a concern. If I were to get a positive on the stool test, then what am I going to do? Because now I need a colonoscopy. And depending on where you are in the country and where you access care, there are programs that are available to people to help coordinate that care and help people access colonoscopy. They're limited, of course. I also know that the private practices and all of our gastroenterologists in town are in private practice, except for the ones in the native system, also are, you know, will work with patients as well. What we also know is that with the Affordable Care Act, the changes that have come with that for people who have insurance, that these preventive screenings are covered through part of the Affordable Care Act, and that's a really important piece of legislation that came with that. Unfortunately, in Alaska, not everyone qualifies for the insurance through the marketplace, and there's a lot of people working really hard on that to kind of figure out what to do with those people who don't qualify because of income for insurance. But you know, the concern about what will happen if I am positive and I don't have money to take care of it, I think needs to be explored further with the provider, because from my mind, that's a scary thought, but it is what it is. And there are often ways that people can get help once they have a diagnosis that you may not be aware of that people can help you with.
Yeah. Jerry, I'm at the other end of the age scale, but if I was involved in any way in your healthcare, I would encourage you to get the, you know, something like the FIT, which would be very inexpensive. And if that was positive and indicated you need a colonoscopy, there's a Project Access. There is a way to get things done. There are, I don't know if you're old enough to be in the Medicare. There's just got to be a way someone would help you. I don't see that, even though it's a difficulty with our healthcare system. I don't want to by any means say that our system's correct, but somebody ought to be able to help you. But I think the easiest way would be somewhere like the Neighborhood Health Center, where it should be relatively inexpensive to get that test. Mm-hmm.
Right, it's a test. It's just the answer what I worry about, you know. It's the wrong answer.
But this is where you're getting back into emotions. The correct answer is get the test, and then talk about it, and then worry.
You may be pleasantly surprised, and then you don't have to worry about it, you know?
Well, I can wait another year, then I'll be 65.
Yep, all right. Yep, that works too. Okay, but right, don't wait too long. All right.
And we've been working actually on there's an Alaska colorectal cancer partnership that the state of Alaska, tribal, American Cancer Society, other groups. And we've been working for 2 years now on a campaign trying to get people who have been previously screened to share their screening stories and encourage others to get screened. And so that's one of those things that if people have been screened, then they can help others around them in their community and their family know how they accessed care, how they dealt with the insurance issues. And so it's really important for people to feel more comfortable with the test and less apprehensive about getting it, both the financial and the emotional issues.
In our last 5 minutes or so, this is an email that's similar in a sense to what we've talked about already, but might be worth just comments again. What are the preferred method of screening? What is the preferred method? There are many people out there who cannot afford to or do not want to undergo colonoscopy. Is there good data to support fecal blood testing? What about the fecal immunochemical test, the FIT test we've been talking about, our stool DNA? So kind of going over that again, but Heidi, you want to comment on that?
Yeah. So again, you know, the best screening test is the one that gets done, really. And this is a perfect example of why it's important to have a choice. And the, I forgot what she was saying about the fecal.
If cost is a barrier, what are your other options? And then there was the fecal DNA test.
Yeah, the stool DNA, as Diana mentioned, has not been officially adopted yet, but it looks like it will be, and it'll be an every 3-year test. And it combines looking for actual DNA from the cancers with the looking for blood in the stool. So it's a little bit different kind of a test, also done at home. And... you know, really, again, we recommend the one that's going to get done. The fecal immunochemical test is a very acceptable form of screening. And it has been shown to decrease mortality as well, which is why it's still in the screening guidelines. Because it detects blood, and then it can lead to further screening and diagnosis and prevention. So you can feel very comfortable with choosing the fecal immunochemical test or the high sensitivity fecal occult blood test as your preferred screening method, and get that done every year.
One more quick question before we kind of try to sum up. Is there a connection between Clostridium difficile, or C. diff, as people may hear it, infections and colon cancer?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that connection.
None of us make that connection unless it's somehow related to some other bowel problem that it may be just coincidental with. So we're in our last couple of minutes, and I'd love to summarize things. We want people to go away with one or two things that they will take away that they'll try to remember from this. Who wants to go first?
I can go. I think one thing to just remember is that here in Alaska, 4 out of 10 people who in that age group of 50 to 75 are not screened. So if you're one of those folks, talk to your provider about getting screened. And for those who have been screened, share your story and encourage your friends and family to do it as well and prevent this cancer.
Heidi?
Yeah, and my important summary point is really has to do with screening as well. You have a choice. Advocate for your health. Talk to your provider about screening for colon cancer, and know that this is a great cancer to catch early and to prevent. So it's worth it.
All right, so we want people to go out there and get tested early before they may have symptoms, preferably. And you need to just ask about it each time you're in seeing your provider. When's the right time for you? And what's the best test? And don't let money be the biggest issue here, it sounds like. There's reliable tests that are relatively inexpensive. Listen, thanks very much. This is my guests today are Dr. Diana Redwood and Dr. Heidi Baines. If you'd like to continue this conversation about colorectal cancer, you can join KSK on Facebook. The link for that is found on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find those Line 1 archives I mentioned before. At the same place, you can leave us your thoughts and suggestions about the programs. After about 40 years of research and treatment with veterans of our wars and victims of child maltreatment, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk has concluded that psychological trauma is probably America's number one health threat. He's written a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and has been called one of the most intelligent and helpful works on trauma. On the next Line 1, Dr. van der Kolk will join our host, Prentice Pemberton, in a discussion about the devastating impacts of trauma on our mind and our body. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, March 30th at 2 p.m., Remember, the program repeats each Monday evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson was our web editor and audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.